Welcome to Law & Disorder. Today we're going in-depth on tort reform with Steve Peskin and Shoshana Bookson.
By tort reform, that's what the Bush administration calls it. What it really means is we can't sue the bad guys anymore. Pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, and others are literally going to get away with murder.
We'll talk to Avi Cover about Alberto Gonzalez.
Alberto Gonzalez, who proves the theorem that the more you torture, the higher up you go in the administration.
Michael Avery will join us. He's a former president of the National Lawyers Guild to talk about the national security state and what we can expect in the years ahead.
When you look at your American Express bill, your telephone bill, someone else will have already gone over it before you.
Barbara Dudley's here to talk with us about America's economic global entanglements.
Entanglement has an interesting meaning here. It really means the rich countries get richer and the poor countries get poorer.
All that and more coming up on this hour of Law & Disorder.
Welcome to Law & Disorder. I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Dalia Hashad, Arab-Muslim South Asian Advocate for the ACLU.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author. The great civil liberties attorney, Bill Kunstler, saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned, bit by bit, step by step, and at some point it'll be irreversible.
Here on Law & Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. We'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be lawyers and activists you'll like.
They know where to move. We have to be vigilant. We have to make sure their lawyers are out there to protect us all.
LynnStewart.org is the site. Lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T, LynnStewart.org.
There's a sample letter there that you can modify and make your own.
And what's the phone number?
The Office of the Defense Committee, take this down, 212-625 9696.
Lynn is confined to New York, but she can go anywhere in New York State, so she can speak. And outside of the state, we've got a speakers bureau.
No matter what your relationship with the case is or what you do, everyone really has an interest in making sure that the attorney-client privilege is preserved, that people aren't randomly indicted around the country, and that more Osama bin Ladens aren't brought into court to really sway the outcome of cases like this.
Heidi, we were together in that ceremonial courtroom over in federal court February 10th when the verdict came in on the Lynn Stewart case.
Stunning afternoon, absolutely unexpected. You know,
they got her and the other two defendants in every single charge.
You know, her attitude and spirit are remarkable. She just bounced right back and re-energized the Lynn Stewart Defense Committee.
But I tell you what, I think people need to know is just how the government engineered this frame-up. Tell me what you're thinking, but I think the way they did it was in two ways. They got her on this special administrative measure, SAM, SAMS, you know?
Right.
They had her sign it. Now, remember, this is 2 years before 9/11. This is before Bush. This is before Ashcroft. And she's trying to visit her client in prison. And they get her to sign this thing saying, you can't say what this guy thinks to the outside world. And then
if she didn't sign it, she couldn't visit him.
Right. So she signs it. And then she violates it because 2 years later, she issues a press release to Reuters. But in the meantime, there's 9/11. There's Ashcroft, who flies into New York to announce her indictment on the David Letterman show. Which is obviously unethical. And the country is scared to death. So what did they do? They get her not on violating a SAMS, which is a violation, slap on the wrist. They tell you, if you do, you can't see your client again. What do they get her on? They get her on fraud, defrauding the government by knowingly signing this thing when you know you're going to violate it. So this is like 2020 hindsight, 2 years later. They get her on that. That's like the first bootstrap. And then the other one was they formed this amalgam, this mixture between her and one of the other defendants. They should have never tried these two people together. Sattar, who was in contact with a guy named Taha, who's an unindicted co-conspirator in this case. Taha is an Egyptian. He's in the Islamic group. And Taha's in contact, follow the logic here, he's in contact with Osama bin Laden's son. So by 3 degrees of separation, now they got Lynn in contact with Osama. Lynn says, you take a skunk and you throw it into the jury box and you can't tell the jury not to smell it.
I think what listeners should be aware of is that, first, the initial indictments against Lynn were thrown out as being too vague. And then the government came back with a superseding indictment.
Yeah, for the conspiracy. The conspiracy was they got Sattar conspiring to kill some unknown person or persons in some unknown country at some unknown time. And they got Lynn for conspiring to provide material aid, that is her client.
Right.
That's a novel theory.
Right.
To the conspiracy of Sattar. That's how they got her on the two conspiracy charges.
The law is actually 18 U.S.C. section 2339A.
I'm impressed that you know
that. Well, it basically prohibits a person from providing material support to terrorists, but it's very narrowly defined. And the definitions defined therein don't really encompass Lynn's alleged actions, excepting only her conduct in providing expert advice or assistance.
In this atmosphere of fear, when you got a vulnerable person like Lynn, imagine, you know, they indicted an co-conspirator. They could have got Ramsey Clark and put him in the box, but they didn't want to go over the former Attorney General of the United States. They ain't going to go over. The meeting was held on February 10th. The church was full of people, about 500 people, standing room only. I was chairing it. I remember looking out and seeing you, Heidi. And just then, Lynn walked in, and people stood up and were clapping. And, it was a wonderful moment. And then she took the podium and gave the speech.
I'm happy to say I came down from Harlem. I had my buttons pushed by the best in the business, Nellie Bailey, who said, "You're going to the rally in the church, but don't forget about us up here." So I made both rallies, and I'm telling you, 200 people turned out in Harlem. 200 people who are ready to do this. And I was on speakerphone to Bellingham, Washington for their rally, and I spoke on the radio in Portland as well, of course, as our own WBAI, who has always been there. Tuesday night on the way home, we're at the drugstore, and who comes on the radio but I have to say my friend and comrade, Mumia Abu-Jamal. His clear, concise statement is for you to take. He buried, I said to Ralph, buried in the belly of the beast on death row, can take the time to elucidate, to champion. If Mumia can do it, what can we do out here? We need to create the climate in which jurors are not afraid, in which the people are not afraid. I was asked on the radio in Portland, Oregon today whether I really thought that fascism was the word to be used about what was happening here. And I remembered back when I was a teenager in the early 50s, they used to talk about, some of my relatives, about creeping socialism, that the country was going to be, wake up one morning, it would be socialist, and proof of that was Social Security and the welfare system, and would that it had happened. But we really have been subjected to creeping fascism, and it comes in very slowly, but it still wears those boots. And it still stands on your neck when you least expect it. And it still comes out. And I said to them in Oregon, I said, it's not creeping anymore. It's galloping. And we need to stop it now. And there are people in the audience who I know have been fighting fascism in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, and the 80s, and the 90s, up until today. And I know we are tired, but we must continue, because there is no other place to go. If we don't fight it, it will take over, and we will not be able to live a life or be the human beings that we need and want to be. But I want to close by saying we are going to fight, and you know, it's a funny thing. People told me when they got up on Friday morning, they were just so disheartened. They just wanted to go back to bed and hide under the covers. I think that our attitude has to be like the attitude of my dear friend, who has been my friend since I was 15 years old, who called me on Friday morning and said, "I'm not sad, I'm fighting mad. I'm so angry at these people. How dare they do this?" And we are going to organize around that. I know that that's what's being spoken of. We have some sample letters. There's some on the website as well. And we are also anxious and happy to send people out. If you can get together 10 people that aren't here tonight, we will come to you, 5 people, and we will talk to you about how to write these letters, where they should be directed, and what it's possible to say in the letters. We also, of course, want a tremendous outpouring for the sentencing date, which is now in September, which, as activists, we all know is a better month than July to get people out. There's nobody in vacationing. There's no school teachers gone. This is a good month in New York, September. Everybody's out there. Everybody's ready to do something. So we're looking for a tremendous turnout that day. I'd like to fill up Thomas Paine Park down there and just have it shoulder to shoulder so that they understand something about who they are trying to mess with.
That was Lynn Stewart from her wonderful evening at the Community Church in New York this February.
She was framed up in the same courtroom that 55 years ago Ethel Rosenberg was sentenced to death. Ethel Rosenberg was totally innocent. The government knew it at the time. She had 2 children, 1 age 4, 1 age 6. They left them orphans. And when Ethel was in court, unlike Lynn, she didn't take the stand in her own defense. There was nobody there supporting her. The judge defiled her, telling her that she was responsible for killing 50,000 Americans in Korea. She was demonized and despised and sentenced to death and murdered in an electric chair in Sing Sing 3 years later. Compare that to Lynn Stewart rally. That she gets up there, she speaks to 500 people. Mm. We're talking now to 100,000 or more people in the tri-state area. Mm. There are a lot of people from left to right that understand the importance of this thing. And compare that to how they got Ethel Rosenberg. There's going to be a different outcome here.
Yes.
We got a movement here.
Yes. Joining us now to talk about the national security state is Professor Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild and constitutional law professor at Suffolk Law School in Boston. Welcome, Michael, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm nice to be with you.
Hi, Michael. It's Michael Smith. You know, when last I saw you, it was in Birmingham, Alabama at the National Lawyers Guild convention. You gave such a good talk there, and we're grateful to have you on the air. We wanted to ask you if you might recap for us what you said then about the real degeneration in democratic rights in this country and what you think we can expect in the coming year.
Well, you know, I think most Americans have blithely assumed that our experiment in constitutional democracy would just go on forever. But I'm afraid that we're going to follow the path of most regimes and certainly all empires, and that we're now looking at the demise of our constitutional democracy and the creation in America of a national security state.
And what do you mean by that?
What I mean by a national security state is one in which the executive department is really running the government, where we've eliminated much of the protection that is afforded by separation of powers, where there's little or no judicial review of principal decisions that are made by the executive department, particularly those relating to security, where we have a visible increase in uniform security in our society, less accountability for law enforcement, spying on targeted individuals and groups, and increased surveillance of the citizenry generally, and a society that's organized around a national mission that, at least on its face, claims it has something to do with protecting our security.
Unhappily, I totally agree with you. It's been before, but especially since 9/11, just shocking, the boldness and the aggressiveness that they've shown in unfolding that agenda. Just recently, with the latest law they've passed on the Homeland Security Act, I think they've taken giant steps in the wrong direction. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Let's just consider one example of what the government is now able to do, which is the use of national security letters by the government. This is something that has received much less attention in the public press than it deserves. There's a lot of concern about the ability of the government to find out what library books you're reading and so on and so forth. But actually, much more important than that is the fact that the FBI now has the power, under the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, to send letters to those institutions in society that keep many of our most private records, financial institutions, medical providers, credit agencies, banks, and the like. And to get information about us from these different institutions without any subpoena, without any court review, with no opportunity for those of us whose records are collected in this way to challenge what's happening. And all this takes place without the knowledge of the people whose records are being gathered, because it's a felony for anybody who receives one of these national security letters from the government to inform the person whose records are being collected. Now, this really stands a lot of our constitutional protections on their heads. In the ordinary course, in order to get private information about a person, the government has to go first to a court and convince a judge that there's sufficient reason, some sufficient governmental interest, usually having to do with some proof that the person's involved in criminal activity, some sufficient reason to invade that person's privacy. But what we see under the Patriot Act and under the Homeland Security Act is an ability by the government to invade in a dragnet fashion the privacy of thousands and millions of Americans with no judicial review whatsoever.
And no one knows this is happening for the most part.
For the most part, nobody knows what they're doing. We only learned a little bit about it last year because in a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that the ACLU filed, the government turned over some information about what it had been doing. I'm quite certain only the tip of the iceberg. But even from that tip of the iceberg, we could see that the records they were gathering are staggering. Just to give you an example, anybody who visited Las Vegas during the last 2 weeks of the last calendar year had their records, their hotel records, their flight records, their rental car records, all were collected by the government. Everybody who visited Las Vegas during that period of time, their records were swept up in this dragnet search. That's a staggering idea.
Why, Michael?
Why, yeah.
Evidently, the government had some information, we don't even know what it was, that something may have been happening in Las Vegas during that period of time that the government claimed was related to national security, and all they have to do is have the thinnest of reasons for that, and then instead of focusing the investigation on a particular person or a particular place, they can conduct this type of dragnet investigation.
Las Vegas Tourism Bureau this past year has been doing an advertising campaign with the slogan, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
That's funny. Mike, we've got Michael Avery, president of the National Lawyers Guild, on the line. Michael, comment for us, will you, on the Homeland Security Act's provision to make a unified national driver's license and also a unified national birth certificate. What's the meaning of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. If we go back to 1935, when the Social Security Act was adopted, and when Americans were assigned a Social Security number, there was a huge debate in Congress at that time about whether that Social Security number would become a universal identification number. And in fact, written into the law was the notion that the use of the Social Security number would have to be limited. And then, as recently as 1968, when the Privacy Act was passed, it was underlined that government agencies are not allowed to use the Social Security number as a universal identification number. What we have now...
Well, Michael, on that, how come everybody does, though? I knew about that law, but every time I get a form of any sort, it asks me for my Social Security number.
Well, first of all, the law doesn't apply to private information gatherers, but just to the government. And secondly, most government agencies ignore it. So that has pretty much been thrown out the window. But I mention it to show that Americans have always been suspicious and have always tried to protect themselves from some form of internal passport control in this country. Now, the questions you asked about the driver's license and so on are clear steps toward adopting some type of internal passport. And if you think about it, the functions of an internal passport are already being performed when you go to the airport and you have to show some state-issued identification, usually your driver's license, to get on the airplane. They even have that on Amtrak now. When you go to pick up your ticket, you're supposed to show your identification. It's going to be that when you check into a hotel or when you use public services, you'll have to show that identification, so that the government's ability to track us, to track all of our movements all the time, has expanded hugely. And not satisfied with that, not satisfied with the idea of making people show identification, there are now more and more proposals for the installation of global tracking devices, GPS, global positioning
system.
These GPS devices are being installed on automobiles, cell phones. There are even some medical providers who are urging parents to install them under their children's skin so that if the children are kidnapped, they can be found.
Like they do for pets now.
Yeah, only they're going to do it for people. And so we are going to have virtually no ability to remain anonymous. And the significance of that is that anonymity is very important to dissent. Anonymity is very important to giving people the sense of freedom and the confidence that they can dissent from their government's policies, that they can protest, that they can raise questions about what's happening in their country without losing their job, without being subjected to a variety of penalties. But we are at serious risk of losing that anonymity completely.
Michael, can you give any suggestions for listeners about what kinds of things we can do on a day-to-day level to fight back?
Well, I think, first of all, people have to inform themselves about what's happening. And secondly, I think people have to begin to insist at every opportunity that they have that the terrorism concern that is fueling all of this is grossly overblown. I saw that yesterday Richard Goldstone, who was the first chief prosecutor at the war crimes tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, came out and made a statement that the United States terror war is a complete overreaction. People need to do something to restore their confidence in our safety in this country. The administration has succeeded in turning us into a nation of frightened sheep, And we need to, you know, we need to take back ownership of our own society.
So how do you do it, Michael?
Well, I think people have to organize. I think people have to go to the Democratic politicians in this country who have been running, you know, with rare exceptions. Barbara Boxer comes to mind for standing up to Condoleezza Rice. But with rare exceptions like that, the Democrats have been running away from the Constitution and away from our civil liberties almost as fast as the Republicans. We have to go to our elected officials, whether on a local level, like the Bill of Rights Defense Committee does, where people have passed these local resolutions against the Patriot Act, or on a national level, to our senators and congressmen. We have to let people know that they have to fight back against this.
Michael, our producer just passed us a note, and I want to ask you this, saying that there's a sophisticated tracking system embedded in U.S. currency. Have you heard about that?
I have not.
Have you heard about their putting biometrics on driver's license and birth certificates?
I have heard that. Yes, I have heard that.
Is that a proposal, or is that a fact, or is that a fantasy? What have you heard?
I don't know whether that's been instituted or not.
By biometrics, you mean a way of identifying the person whose card that is through that person's makeup or biology? Is that the idea?
Yeah. Put your DNA. Encode your DNA on your driver's license.
You did hear the one I read, I'm sure, the other day, Michael, that for getting through the lines rapidly when you're leaving the country or entering the country, you can have your iris scanned and do iris scans, and they're going to test this at Kennedy, and then after you have your iris scanned and they identify you like that, you also, to get the special card, you get interviewed by someone from Homeland Security, and then you
the
can get the special...
trusted traveler.
Right,
program,
and then you
yeah.
the trusted traveler, and then you can go right in and out. I don't think that, I won't speak for everybody here, but I'm sure that some of the people on this program won't make it through the iris scan.
Well, you know, Michael, what they're creating with some of these things is a two-tier society. And we already have that. I read an article in the paper yesterday about Hartford, Vermont. Hartford, Vermont, which is 100 miles from the Canadian border, has a checkpoint that you have to go through. And the people of color in that community call it the White Pass checkpoint or something, because if you're white, you sail right through. And if you're African-American, or if you appear to be Muslim or Arab or South Asian, you don't sail right through.
It's exactly like what happened up at Buffalo when Muslims who attended a conference in Toronto were trying to get back into the country, many of them who live right there on the border in the United States, all of whom had U.S. passports, were held for 6-7 hours while their identity was checked, while they were fingerprinted, while they were photographed. And they watched white people sail straight through the border.
Well, you know, people ask about many of these things that we've been talking about this morning. They say, What's the danger? What's the problem with all of this? But the underlying problems, you know, it's not privacy for privacy's sake, although that's important, but the underlying problems are the elimination of free speech, the right to dissent, and the creation of a caste society where we have people who are much worse off than others because of their ethnic background.
Michael, this is chilling, really, what you've said.
Well, I think people need to wake up, and we need to make some demands on people in this country with some power to get in the way of what's happening.
Michael Avery, thank you very much. We've come to the end of the segment, but we certainly appreciate Michael Avery, head of the National Lawyers Guild, being on Law and Disorder. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Really terrific interview, Michael.
Bye, Michael.
That was Michael Avery, current president of the National Lawyers Guild. Thank you very much.
Joining us now in the studio is Barbara Dudley, former president of the National Lawyers Guild and also former executive director of Greenpeace USA. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Heidi.
Hi. With all those formers, Barbara, what are you actually doing now?
What I'm doing now, let's see. I'm teaching at Portland State University. I teach political science. I'm working here with Military Law Task Force on a few cases, stop-loss cases, and I'm working with the State Federation of Labor.
Barbara, since terrific. I've known you for the last 20 years, you've been consistently a troublemaker. Remember, I saw you last in Birmingham, Alabama, for the National Lawyers Guild convention, and you gave such a fine speech. That's why we all wanted you on the show. Can you tell us in a nutshell what you told us then? If you give us an idea of what your research has showed on the global economic situation, I think there's a tie-in between that and the inclination of this country to constantly break national, international law.
Well, actually, what the panel that I was part of when I gave that speech in Birmingham was about sort of the stretch of empire in general. And I was trying to relate the economic stretch to the military stretch because obviously they're very interrelated and we tend, even on the left, I think, to separate them a lot. And I think what we can expect is very interesting on the economic front in the coming year. I mean, it's probably more interesting in some ways than what we can expect militarily because it's less predictable. What is the big picture is about the trade agreements that are already in force and that are coming into consideration by Congress. One of the things that has happened that I think the left has lost track of is the WTO went into effect in 1995. And since then has become an object, as we all know, of many protesters and a lot of resistance. But what we don't know is that it has become an instrument for the United States economic policy to be seriously challenged by developing countries. And as a result, what's happening is that many conservatives in Congress, along with the one or two progressives in Congress, are actually talking about pulling the U.S. out of the WTO because the WTO has ruled against the United States in a few cases. And that, as you know, since we won't submit to the International Criminal Court, we'll be damned if we're going to submit to an International Economic Court either. And that's what the WTO is on some level. The other thing that's going on is because the U.S. is unwilling to give up its position of privilege, specifically around agricultural issues, but many other issues as well, and insisting that we can continue subsidizing our farmers to the tune of $80 billion in the last farm bill, but that developing countries cannot subsidize their farmers because they can't give direct subsidies. What they do instead is do import protections, and that was made illegal by the WTO, whereas our form of direct welfare to rich farmers is not made illegal by the WTO. Well, the developing countries are rebelling against this, led by Brazil and a few other key countries. They're basically refusing to go along with other aspects of the WTO until the U.S. brings its reality into line with its rhetoric. So that all of that means that this is going to be a year of tremendous, tremendous upheaval in the world of so-called free trade.
But you know, Barbara, yeah. If the economy here does go into the tank, and I do agree with you, I think that it's only a matter of time. I think that they're gearing up now for that with the kind of police state legislation that they've put through ever since 9/11, before 9/11, but ever since also.
They certainly are in a position to repress anybody and anything that they want to repress at this stage of the game. I mean, the only thing that's between them and us is a very few friendly faces in Congress who might find that somewhat appalling, and the remaining few faces in the judiciary who still believe in the Constitution, but they're few and far between.
I want to go back, Barbara, for a second to the WTO stuff. Mm-hmm. I have two sorts of questions. One is, when you talk about subsidies that we're giving to our, like, American cotton farmers and others, mm-hmm. How much harm does that actually cause in undeveloped countries to people? And if we change that, would there be a change in poverty rate, et cetera, in those countries?
Well, that's the big debate. And in fact, because Oxfam and others who've been historically part of the anti-WTO contingent have said that that is the way out of poverty for the developing countries, is for the U.S. and Europe to drop their agricultural subsidies, because what the developing countries have to export are agricultural commodities. But there are plenty of activists in developing countries who would say that's absolutely the wrong approach. And the most interesting development, actually, Michael, in the world these days is the sort of alliance that's being built between China and Brazil and Mexico and South Africa, who are seeing themselves as sort of the big brothers, perhaps in the bad sense of the word as well as the good, toward the least developed countries, and starting to talk about trade regimes that could actually be free trade agreements, or trade agreements, not free trade agreements in the sense that we think of them, but trade agreements amongst developing countries, or regional trade agreements that exclude the U.S. and exclude Europe. And that's starting to happen more and more. Now, one can really question whether, you know, one should trust the Chinese or even trust the Brazilians for that matter, because despite the fact that they have a progressive government, they are a huge economy that's very dependent on agricultural exports themselves. But it is a positive in the sense that it's breaking the bond that the Europeans and primarily the United States has with these developing countries, the economic bonds, and giving them alternative ways of paths of development that they can think about.
Yeah, no, I have seen the Chinese making huge gains, and certainly in terms of their relationships with countries in South America,
absolutely,
as well as the Caribbean. I think that's going to become a bigger and bigger issue for the United States. Back on the WTO for a second, I know you've described it pretty well, what's going on. The question, if I look going forward for the year for activists, what kinds of pathways are there for us? What kind of alternatives? What kinds of things should we be looking to do? What are some of the goals in the next year?
Well, one of the most specific and immediate things that's going to be coming up is going to be a vote in Congress to approve the Central America Free Trade Agreement. And that should and honestly could be opposed. I think that there is a real possibility of an alliance being made in Congress that would give us a real majority to destroy CAFTA and bring it down. And if that happens, you're going to see a snowball effect where I think the free trade area of the Americas, the one that encompasses all of North and South America and Central America except Cuba, as they will always say, that the free trade area of the Americas is really, really on the ropes itself. And if CAFTA goes down, the FTAA is going to go down. And that will start a momentum that I think will blow up these trade agreements altogether. I think NAFTA is under incredible pressure right now. There's a lawsuit being filed in Canada that may have some chance of success, but mostly NAFTA is becoming sort of a bête noire for the states, a state-by-state thing of the states that have a lot of trade with either Canada or Mexico. They're starting to resist a lot of the terms of NAFTA that allow corporations to sue the government directly and those sorts of things. So this whole regime could easily fall. And if the right-wingers join forces with the progressives to pull out of the WTO, we have like a blank slate then. We start all over again. And I think that the possibilities of coming up with a better trade regime are really strong, because you have countries like Brazil that have become very wise in the ways of trade negotiations now and are standing up for their interests and the interests of the developing world.
Barbara, one last thing. What kind of places can people go to for more information? What are some websites? What are some organizations that they can look at?
Well, WTOwatch.org is the place to go, or TradeObservatory.org are the places to go for as much information as anybody could possibly digest on these things. The Citizens Trade Campaign is still alive and well and is the principal coordinator of the WTO activities. The trade unions, I know the state Fed here is in the leadership on trade work, and I assume that's true in most other states. I can't vouch for New York, though. Your state Fed sometimes leaves something to be desired. So But I think in general, to just go to Citizens Trade Campaign, and the websites are WTO Watch or Trade Observatory.
Thanks, Barbara. This is Michael Smith, Michael Ratner, Hyde Bogosian, Dahlia Shad. We're all very grateful you're on the show. It's nice to talk to you, and you have a good year. We're real happy to have with us today two exceptional trial lawyers in New York, Shoshana Buxton, who is the head of the New York State Trial Lawyers Association, that's my organization, and Steve Peskin, who is the delegate from New York to the American Trial Lawyers Association, another organization of mine. I don't claim to be detached in any way here, but this is going to be an objective show, and it's going to be about what the Bush administration calls tort reform. Shoshana, what's wrong with calling something tort reform? They say there's a crisis in medical care. Doctors are quitting. Insurance premiums are too high. People aren't getting care. And it's all the result of people like you and Steve and me, what Bob Doyle said, those trial lawyers and tassel loafers. What's wrong with the conception of tort reform?
Well, thanks for having me here, first of all. It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you.
Thank you. The problem with calling it tort reform is that it makes it seem like there is a crisis when there is no crisis at all. Civil filings of lawsuits are down. They've been going down. Medical malpractice lawsuit filings are down. Payouts are down on medical malpractice cases. So the number one fallacy is that these are out of control awards in an out-of-control system, which is not true. The next thing is that there is some relationship between the tort system and the insurance premiums that are being charged by the insurance companies that regulate this. That is a complete fallacy. They have constructed this argument in such a way to make people believe that if they cap damages, if they restrict people's rights to courthouses, and they limit accountability of doctors and hospitals in medical malpractice cases, that somehow that will eliminate the majority of the costs of insurance for either patients or doctors. And that is simply not true. And the way we know that it is not true is because there are a number of states over the last couple of years who have bought this argument and who have enacted laws with caps. And in those states, the amount of the insurance premiums have actually gone up, in contrast to the states like New York, where we have no caps and our premiums have not been going up. They did have an increase last year, but over the last 5 years overall, our premiums have not gone up in any way close to the way it's been going up in the states in which they have enacted caps. Where's the crisis?
Well, what do you say to that, Steve? You've got people saying Arizona, where OBGYN doctors are paying $110,000 a year in premiums, and they're saying, I'm not going to practice medicine anymore, and then they cut to some kid who's no longer getting medical care. What do you say to that?
Michael, thank you again for having me. Shoshana's being extremely diplomatic. She's the president of New York State Trial Lawyers. I'm a past president. There's nothing, no diplomatic immunity is needed. Joseph Goebbels said it best in World War II, the great lie, the big lie. If you tell a lie loud enough and long enough, people are going to buy into it. And the Bush-Cheney juggernaut are masters at perfecting this lie and carrying it forward, be it weapons of mass destruction or a crisis
in Social Security.
You name it, it's a crisis. If you scream crisis long enough, people are going to get panicked and flock and follow their leader. This is absurd. It's patently absurd. The bottom line here is you have a client that has been catastrophically injured by a tortfeasor, a defendant. The question is, who pays the damages? Does the party who's proven to be responsible, or are the damages spread over the entire population in the form of having welfare pick up the costs of these people's medical care and their pain and suffering? It's kind of sophistry to say to a woman whose husband, the breadwinner, has suffered a catastrophic injury, is a paraplegic, can't move his hands, can't move his legs. When he goes to the toilet, she has to wipe his behind. She and the kids have to feed him, incapable of doing anything. You're going to tell this family, this mother and these children, that $250,000 is all they can get for his pain and suffering and their pain and suffering and watching this once great breadwinner be a vegetable. Oh, yes, we'll also give you the best medical care the state has to offer. Well, you know, God help us when it comes down to that.
What exactly does the Bush administration mean when they say tort reform? What do they really want to do?
They want to eliminate the opportunity for people who are injured to go to courts and seek redress from juries. They would prefer to have administrative proceedings. They would prefer to have arbitrations, any form of non-judicial intervention.
And I think it goes even deeper than that. What they really want to do is to take away the basic rights of every American to have their playing field level against the strongest institutions, medical institutions, hospitals, and by the way, drug companies, which have been tacked on to all of these measures as a side thought, when really those are probably the ones that are driving this whole movement to begin with. And what they really want to do is to provide immunity to corporations and drug companies and hospital corporations all across this country from any mistake that they make. And we know they make mistakes all the time.
How many people do they kill a year in hospitals, Shoshana?
98,000 people a year are killed in hospitals by the studies that were done several years ago, and it's probably gone up since. And I don't have to tell you how many dangerous drugs are out there every day of the week. We're reading in the newspaper about the newest that is either being taken off the market or being criticized for being on the market because of the millions of people who it is either killing or maiming. What's really going on here, and I'll be a little more blunt about this from the Bush administration's point of view, is their mindset is, how can we take away the threat of a jury of average American people from taking a look at corporate activities that hurt average Americans? How can we take away that threat and protect our largest corporations and our largest Fortune 500 companies? And the best way to do it is exactly what they're doing, which is to take away the rights of these cases being heard in court. And even if they are being heard in court, which very few will be with this type of reform, then the damages are limited to a minimal amount. And when I say minimal, that's the $250,000, because it may sound like a lot of money to people who don't think about it in terms of a catastrophically injured individual. But like Steve says, if you're talking about people that need round-the-clock, 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week care, $250,000 for their lifetime, where they can never come back to court ever again, no matter what their costs are, no matter what their expenses are, this is a drop in the bucket. This is lunch money to these corporations.
So when corporations are doing the cost-benefit analysis of making a drug safer or making a product safer, this is now. If tort reform, you know, quote unquote, happens, it's going to be a completely different analysis.
Completely different. We have seen time and again in so many cases of corporations with defective, dangerous products, case after case that has come to court, where in the light of the courtroom, it's been disclosed that for 2 cents, for 5 cents, for 25 cents, for a dollar, they could be saving lives. And they make corporate decisions in those boardrooms that it is not worth it, and they are willing to not spend that money, and they don't care what the consequences are. And now they're just trying to catch up to, now we're going to know what the consequences are. We're going to limit it. We're going to take away those rights, and we'll never, ever have a fear of any lawsuit coming at us with any injured people, because all we'll ever have to pay, ever, no matter how badly we either kill or maim somebody, is $250,000. It is frightening to me that the administration has been so successful in brainwashing, basically, the American public, that this is a good thing for the American public. And the other part of it that they argue is they're only limiting what they call non-economic damages. This is really important, because what they are always saying is, well, if you can prove economic lost earnings, you'll get every penny of that. But that only helps the injured people who have been proven wage earners. The majority of the people that are hurt in these types of lawsuits are children, elderly, full-time homemakers, non-full-time working people whose lives are actually destroyed. I know these people. I see them every day. And if you want to say that it's okay to limit their non-economic damages, then what you're saying is the value of their existence, the quality of their lives, is minimal.
Thank you. Shoshana Bookson, the president of the New York State Trial Lawyers Association. We have also Steve Peskin, who is the delegate from New York to the American Trial Lawyers Association. Steve, one question, not on product liability, but on medical malpractice, because they are trying to put caps on that. Just how much medical malpractice is there in the United States?
Well, the majority, I believe, of medical malpractice cases or doctor neglect cases go unsued because the patient is the last person to find out that the doctor's made an error, something called the great white wall of silence. The doctors don't say anything. You know, the worst thing you can hear when you wake up out of anesthesia is whoops. The number of doctors that are sued for malpractice is remarkably small in percentage to the number of doctors actually practicing. And of the doctors sued, the level of recidivism is amazingly high. I don't know what the statistics are. Shoshana, you remember those statistics? I think it's 1% of all of the doctors have 90% of, you know, the malpractice claims.
That's been my practical experience.
It's very close to that. It's
the same people keep popping up as defendants.
Exactly.
Right, and there's a reason for that.
And the rest of the profession is paying for those bad apples, which gets to the issue of the profession's lack of discipline and disciplinary action against their own profession, which is notorious and is national. It's not state. It's not a state issue. It's a national issue.
I know. We just had a case in my firm out in Nassau County where the pain management doctor stuck a needle full of steroids and air into my client's spinal cord. And we Googled the doctor, and, you know, he'd done it to 8 other people. Mm-hmm. And when we started that trial, we had 2 of the people he did it to sitting in the front row. That doctor was shaken up, and 2 days later they settled the case. Mm-hmm. A lot of doctors are repeated offenders, and they're not disciplined, and they let them slide.
Mm-hmm. And Shoshana mentioned something a while ago about a study that was done that says how dangerous hospitals are. It's surprising. That study was done back in 1992. It was done by the Harvard University School of Medicine. You couldn't have a better credentialed organization.
And published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
And set up by the doctors and the insurance companies, because they thought they were going to be vindicated. And what it pointed out is that one of the most dangerous places in the world is to be in a hospital. The majority of people that die in a hospital die of infection. A hospital is where sick people are. Infections attack the sickest people and cause the ultimate injuries to those people. So I'm not surprised at those numbers. But there are certain hospitals where the fatality rate is so high that you would be best lying in the street and having a faith healer come up to you. You have a better chance of surviving. And some of those hospitals, unfortunately, are right here in New York City and are operated by the Health and Hospital Corporation of the City of New York.
That's
so
right.
When the City of New York yells and screams about runaway numbers and big ticket verdicts, it's because they hire the most incompetent doctors. The facilities are the most chaotic. Anybody in the listening audience that has ever gone to an emergency room at a city hospital knows precisely what I'm saying. People can sit there for 3, 4, 5 hours, not be attended to. When they are attended to, it's in the mere perfunctory of manner. And serious situations are not diagnosed and are not treated. And that results in a malpractice lawsuit.
But, you know, if you don't have a case that's just a dynamite case, you just have a normal, clear liability case, how many of those cases are lost? Maybe 4 out of 6. Very, very difficult to win a malpractice case. Very difficult.
70% of the verdicts are in favor of the defendants at trial.
Yeah.
70%. I mean, 7 out of 10 cases, the doctors or the hospitals win. Only 3 out of 10, very clear minority, are where the patients win.
And if you believe that the insurance companies don't know that and don't roll the dice.
Let me ask a question politically about this. What do you suggest people do? I mean, is it a congressional thing that they have to go to their congresspeople, their senators? Is it a statewide thing? What do people do? Where do they get information?
Okay.
What do they do?
Michael, the best thing for people to do is to contact their local members of Congress or the United States senators, Hillary Rodham Clinton and Charles Schumer.
I was going to say, since the real push and the real action at the moment on these issues is federally and not statewide, where the bills are going to be introduced very soon. They have been in the past few sessions and barely got defeated, but they will be reintroduced very soon in the new session starting in Congress, that people should focus their communications with their federal representatives, both Congress people and United States senators.
And do you have a website where they can get information on this?
www.atla.org, O-R-G.
And ATLA, by the way, is the initials for the American Trial Lawyers Association.
And with that, I want to say long live the American Trial Lawyers Association and long live the New York State Trial Lawyers Association.
Amen to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go
Steve Peskin, Shoshana Bookson, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Boy, you can't make it, cause the fever mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, and we have finally dried our eyes. We're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. We're moving on up. We're living proof and all's alert that we're two from the good black turn. And we're a winner, and everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing like your leaders tell you to. At last that blessed day has come, and I don't care where you come from. We're all moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. Moving on up. We're a winner, and everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing like your leaders tell you to. At last that blessed day has come, and I don't care when you come from. We're just gonna move on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. We're moving on up. You know, you may remember reading in your Jet Johnson publications, a whole lot of stations didn't want to play that particular record, We're a Winner. Can you imagine such a thing? Well, I would say the way I'm sure most of you would say, we don't give a damn, we're a winner anyway. Right on? Yeah, I got a little strength out there tonight. Putting fire under us. Out of sight. It's all right now. We have just another version that we'd like to lay to you about here, believing very strongly in the equality and freedom for all, and especially we people who are darker than blue. We'd like to just lay another version to you, trying not to offend anyone, but basically telling it like it is. We're a winner. And never let anybody say, boy, you can't make it, cause a feeble mind is in your way. No more tears do we cry, the black boy done dried his eyes. And we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now. Moving on up. There'll be no more Uncle Tom. At last that blessed day has come, and we're a winner. And everybody knows it too. We just keep on pushing like Martin Luther told you to. And I don't mind leaving here to show the world we have no fear, cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up, we're moving on up. So people get ready, I've got good news for you. How we got over like we're all supposed to do. Let us all say amen, and together we'll clap our hands, 'cause we're moving on up, moving on up. Lord have mercy, we're moving on up now, moving on up. Continue to be a winner, all of you.